Hello, welcome to Pod Catalyst. Today's guest is Josie Cox, a journalist, editor, and broadcaster with an interest in business, the economy, and gender. She's worked for a broad range of media outlets in Germany, Switzerland, the UK, and the US. And as a freelancer, her work has appeared in The Guardian, The Washington Post, and Fortune, to name just a few. She's also appeared as a commentator on CNN, Fox News, Al Jazeera, and Sky News, and as a regular guest on the BBC. Josie is also an associate instructor within the Strategic Communications Program at Columbia School of Professional Studies. Her upcoming book, Women, Money, Power, explores how women have fought for financial freedom and the social and political hurdles that have kept them from equality. The book will be available in March of 2024. She joined IABC Executive Director Peter Finn to discuss some of the research that went into her book, where she sees an opportunity for communicators to influence the conversation around gender inequity, as well as some of the other trends she's keeping a pulse on as a journalist. Let's tune into today's episode.
Well, Josie, thanks so much for joining me and you know, just talking a little bit about your career. But I know, you've had a fascinating career. You've been a journalist in Berlin, Frankfurt, London, and New York. So I'm just fascinated about your career path. And also, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about your book, but you know, I know the topic of financial freedom and women's equality, empowerment are certainly things that you've honed in on in your research. But yeah, I'd love to hear about your background.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Peter. This is really exciting to be on the show. So the short answer is that in my opinion, financial freedom and gender equality, sort of by their very nature and definitions, have to be part of business coverage and economics coverage. So for me, that was always kind of like a foregone conclusion that as a business and economics reporter, I would have to write about those things. But I can give you a little bit more background on how I sort of got to where I am today professionally. And you probably wouldn't guess it from my accent, but I actually grew up in Switzerland in a very small kind of multicultural family. My mother's originally from Czechoslovakia and my father is British, hence the British accent. And they ended up there in the early 1980s. And so I was raised in this very small little rural village on the outskirts of the city of Basel, where I was initially educated actually kind of very much in the public school system in German, and then later for high school in a sort of international school system. And I chose to go to college in the UK because I wanted to kind of explore my heritage a little bit more, but also, I mean, let's face it, I was 18 years old. We all want to get away from our parents, don't we, at that age? So that's kind of how I ended up in the UK. And like many people who end up being journalists, my route in was through student media. So I wrote for the campus newspaper. I went to the University of Bath in the south of England. And I just discovered that I loved talking to people. And I really, really loved just exploring the sort of human condition, you might say, you know, why people do things and to what effect, and the power dynamics as well, which that sort of is a sort of precursor to covering business, I think. And while I was doing undergrad, I took a year off to go to Germany. I had grown up speaking German, so I was fortunate enough to get some work experiences at Reuters in Berlin, which then helped me to secure a full-time job at Reuters after I graduated, which was kind of nothing short of a miracle because it was right after the financial crisis and, you know, media jobs were extremely hard to come by. So that was wonderful. And I ended up being stationed out in Frankfurt initially, having really basically no financial background, no kind of prior understanding of how financial markets worked. So what I did was I read all of Michael Lewis's books. I got a subscription to the FT and a bunch of other nerdy financial journals and moved over and hoped for the best. And I was very, very fortunate in that I found myself working in a pretty small team that was just extremely supportive and just highly, highly expert in this field. So really, you know, learning by doing. And then I transferred to London with Reuters and eventually moved to the Wall Street Journal, where I was covering markets. And then in 2016, I got hired by The Independent. So I served a stint as business editor at The Independent, which was really when I started professionally and not just personally delving into this very, very complex and depressing topic of inequality, economic inequality, and particularly economic inequality between genders. And I know this is a very long-winded answer to your first question, but it was around that time at The Independent that gender pay gap legislation was coming into effect in the UK. And so I feel like that really, really played a part in why that became kind of my focus and my beat, so to speak. And that legislation specifically mandates all UK companies, all companies based in the UK that employ at least 250 people to annually report the gender pay gap by quartile from lowest pay quartile to highest pay quartile. And so suddenly, kind of overnight, we had access to all this amazing data, which really, you know, spelt out the extent of these very systemic inequalities that were present across not just the UK, but, you know, it kind of gave us an indication of what the situation looked like elsewhere. And so that was sort of, I was off to the races. I was hooked on delving into this data, understanding these systemic inequalities that shape every labor market so profoundly.
And just to talk a bit about your book, Women, Money, Power, that's what kind of what you're talking about led to your research. So what are some things that surprised you about your research? And you think about the UK, but also, you know, were you looking at other regions, you know, especially in the US? It's certainly a hot topic in terms of pay inequality, certainly in like different industries within the US as well. But I'm just curious what kind of surprised you as you were going
through. Yeah. No, that's a great question. And perhaps to help answer it, a little bit of background on how I even came to
the book.
To writing the book. So Women, Money, Power is a project that I've probably been kind of working on consistently and in earnest for about 3.5 years. But I always say that it feels like it would be much more accurate to say that it's been work in progress for kind of a decade or more, because it's really been something that I've just been thinking about since starting to write about finance and about these power dynamics and power imbalances. And then also probably in a more concerted way since 2018, which was when I became a parent. And I sort of had known kind of on an intellectual and cognitive level about these barriers that women, when they become parents, face to realizing their full professional potential and full economic potential. But when I became a parent, that was kind of when I came up against them firsthand and realized, you know, what this actually meant in its full sort of scope. So one of the big things that happened in 2020 was that I relocated to New York. So I'd been living in London for about 10 years. I relocated to New York, actually coincidentally, on pretty much the first day of the COVID-19 pandemic. I arrived at JFK just as the World Health Organization was declaring COVID a global pandemic. So I sort of was in this new city trying to learn about this new environment, trying to kind of gain my bearings all the while the world was in lockdown. But through a sort of series of fortuitous events, I got offered this incredible fellowship from Columbia Journalism School. And it basically meant that I had the opportunity to go back to school for 1 year. And the condition was that I took a step back from reporting and from working, which initially sounded pretty daunting and scary. But in actual fact, it just gave me this incredible opportunity to think, right? And to kind of consider so many of the things that I'd been wanting to think about and wanting to delve in more detail, but sort of the hustle and bustle of everyday life had got in the way. And so during that time, I took a class as part of the fellowship with this incredible professor and writer named Professor Samuel Friedman at Columbia. And he really nurtured sort of this idea that I had for this book on economic inequality. And he really encouraged me to kind of go ahead and pull together a proposal and help me kind of held my hand through the process of getting a book deal, which I managed to do in 2021 for publication, as you mentioned, in March next year. And so the way I've come to sort of sum up Women, Money, Power is that it is a narrative history of female economic empowerment in the US since the Second World War. And it tells the story of the women who affected the greatest legal, social, and political changes. And it explains kind of the hurdles that these individuals had to overcome in order to succeed in their respective missions. And that kind of brings me to the part of your question about what surprised me most. I'd say one of the things was certainly how many of these women affected huge change, but are just not in any way featured in history syllabuses across the country, in history books, who are just kind of not household names in the way that I feel like they should be. And so that was something that was really surprising. And it was also a motivator to get these stories down on paper and to essentially do justice and pay tribute to these women who deserve so much more credit than they're given. And then the other thing that really surprised me was that the book is a chronology. So it sort of starts in the 40s. And, you know, I go into a lot of the detail around the major innovations and developments that led to women getting rights, you know, the right to not being fired from their job for getting pregnant, the right to having their own credit card, the right to getting a mortgage, all of these things. But then, you know, and a lot of those developments are framed with optimism. They are good things that happened. And then we sort of reach a point in the late 80s, early 90s, where there's really a bit of an inflection in terms of progress and a stalling of sorts. And I was just so shocked and surprised to learn of how little progress we've actually been able to make in the last kind of 20 to 30 years. And again, that was just a motivated to shine a light on this stalling and to tell these stories as well.
This is curious too, because talking about UK having this passing legislation or having the policy in place, I mean, do you think that that's really the best way to achieve more, the equality or really accelerate things is by having policies in place, pay inequality?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I would say is that there's certainly no single simple solution solve this, systemic entrenched issue that has kind of dominated the labor market for so many decades. But I do think that transparency creates accountability, right? Mm. And it gives us a chance to, it gives us a metric for actually measuring progress. And there is certainly evidence that gender pay gap reporting and transparency around pay can lead to progress. It doesn't in all cases, and there are many, many caveats. And there's also just not enough data from the UK to categorically be able to say that gender pay transparency mandates have led to a closing of the gender pay gap. There's just not enough data yet. Yeah. But it's certainly one thing that I can say it has achieved in the UK is that it has made the pay gap a mainstream issue. And it's talked about more widely. It is written about more widely. It is a topic of mainstream discussion, both in politics and in business. And I think that that is indisputably, that is progress.
Yeah. I know there's been some movement and there are being more women CEOs, but we're not anywhere where we need to be, especially in the US. I mean, I'd like to get your perspective on culture. I mean, how organizations are getting better at advancing women into executive level positions where you're starting to see more women, in those positions. Because I used to work with engineering organizations, and one of the things that would happen is that you have oftentimes white males only mentoring other white males, never really advocating or really trying to help women in their careers. And I'm not to say that that's the general rule, but I mean, that's certainly a cultural thing that people may just be doing unconsciously. But I was just curious if you have kind of perspective on that as well, just the inner workings of these organizations and how that creates these situations.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to talk about culture because it's such a hard to define concept, isn't it? We can't really measure culture. It's sort of everywhere and nowhere. And it permeates everything, but it's sort of at the same time kind of elusive, And so, when we say we need to fix the culture, what does that actually mean? I think what it does mean is that it means that we need to understand why people are making the decisions that they're making and to what end. And, I think having said that, it is so great that there are more women in leadership. But what we have to understand is that it can't just be that we're fixing a symptom of a more entrenched problem, right? And it can't just be that we're promoting more women into leadership because that's the right thing to do. It has to be that we're addressing inequalities that right throughout every single seniority level of an organization. Mm-hmm. And there was so much fascinating research that I came across for the book. As you were sort of mentioning, I think you were alluding to unconscious biases and the ways in which we as humans naturally tend to trust people who resemble us, who talk like us, who look like us. And there's a chapter in the book where I go into, if we look at sort of the lineup of the CEOs of the largest investment banks in America, bar one, pretty much every single investment bank is run by a white man of a certain age. Yeah. And that is in itself, that is absolutely not a bad thing. But I think it should be a picture that makes us question why that is. Right. And why it's always been like that through history and what it would take to change that and what a change might do to affect changes elsewhere through culture and organizations.
Yeah, no, that's very insightful. I the other thing that's been kind of in the news, of course, is work from home. And there was an article in Times yesterday or 2 days ago. And it was talking about, work from home being kind of a mixed bag. And one of the things that came up is just working moms or working parents and how it's been helpful in terms of flexibility. But there was also mention of how career advancement might be impacted, actually be a impediment for some women to advance or working parents to advance if they're in this sort of hybrid situation. But I was curious, what your perspective is on that and kind of the dynamic of, especially with the last couple of years.
I think you're absolutely on the money. I think it's such a, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a very widely accepted narrative that this approach, this new openness to flexible working, was something that was going to be great for everyone, and it was going to allow everyone to be more flexible around other responsibilities that they might have outside of their day-to-day work schedule and all of that. The reality of it is that what we saw during the pandemic was that defaults were very, very strong, right? And if there was a default caregiver in the house, it was, especially in a heterosexual relationship where a couple has children, the default was still for the woman to pick up the vast majority of caregiving. And that flexibility was basically something that the woman tended to take advantage of. And what we're seeing now, as we're kind of starting to analyze the longer term impact of the pandemic, is that, again, bias comes into the equation, right? Yeah. And actually, way back when, I think it was in 2019, which feels like a lifetime ago now, considering everything that's happened since then, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post around flexible working and why women were more likely to take advantage of it. And also around this idea of availability bias and in the workplace, how, you know, if two people are up for a promotion and one happens to be a man and one happens to be a woman, and the woman is more likely to take advantage of flexible working and she's more likely to work from home more often than the man, then the manager, regardless of what the manager's gender is more likely to promote the man because he's there. He's physically in the office. He's within the manager's line of sight, you know, the whole time. And so it's just a really interesting phenomenon that is something that we should all be acutely aware of as we kind of make these sweeping generalizations around flexibility is great.
Yeah. And the other thing that I just want to ask you about is, you know, because I know that there is also this, you know, sort of dynamic where when people are hired, men will oftentimes start at a higher salary point than a woman. And so, and that just sort of compounds over time, mm-hmm. where when the inequality starts there, it's just going to grow and grow and grow.
Yeah.
Do you see organizations, you know, more mindful of that? Or, you know, I just know that to a certain extent, mm-hmm. I think still happens, but, mm-hmm. but I, you know, and why you get to, you know, where women are paid 70 cents on the dollar versus, you know, so it's where you have that gap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's almost nothing that irritates me more than when I hear from someone that they have had a job interview and one of the questions was, how much were you paid in your previous role? Or what are your salary expectations, right? Because you're immediately indexing yourself.
Yeah.
And you have absolutely, most of the time, you have no visibility over what you could be making, right? You're just essentially drawing on information that you have based on what you were previously paid. And so there is some legislation coming into effect, and we've had legislation come into effect here in New York State around salary bans. So organizations that are posting jobs now have to include a salary band, which is, to the best of their knowledge, how much they are able to pay for the job that they are advertising. There are all kinds of problems with this, and we have seen companies following the letter of the law, I should say, and not necessarily the spirit of the law, in that they are posting extremely wide bans, for example. No. There's also little information available around what actually happens, what the repercussions are of offering a salary that is not within the band that was advertised, right? So again, I think this is a small step in the right direction. But I just think that this idea of compounded inequality is terrifying and real. And it is something that we absolutely need to crack down on. And again, salary data, transparency data, pay gap reporting, all of that can start to combat that.
Yeah. Yep. Well, listeners of this podcast are by and large internal comms, PR, marketing folks. So where do you see the role of these kinds of communicators or people in PR and helping tell the story of gender equality and financial empowerment? Love to get your perspective on that.
Yeah. In short, I think it's absolutely critical. I'm actually, as well as a working as a writer and a journalist, I'm an associate instructor at Columbia University's School for Professional Studies in the Strategic Communications Program, which is such a great program. And one of the things we talk about a lot in the classroom is the responsibility, exactly as you're referring to, that communication professionals have as public-facing individuals. And they really have the power, and this is one thing that I love telling students because I think it's so motivating for them, is that communications professionals have the power to set public agendas. They have the power to inform public opinion. So I believe that, you know, their influence can't really be understated. And because all of this, I think that one of the things that I would like to see more of is just greater diversity in the voices that are publicly heard and that are given a platform to. as a reporter, I understand that it is my responsibility to get my story from the people who can tell it best, right? The people who are living it or who have a particularly unique perspective that is informed and valuable. And I think that communications professionals of all stripes can help to do that. I'm still really amazed at the lack of diversity in media, for example, at how the number of men quoted in news stories is still vastly outnumbers the number of people of any other gender. And I think that it is something that all of us as communicators, journalists, PRs, marketing professionals, scholars of communication as well, have a responsibility to help fix.
Great point. Well, and just to kind of go back to your work as a journalist and thinking about kind of the hot topics when AI has been maybe a source of anxiety for, you know, some people working in communications and media that do a lot of writing, but, you know, the topics like burnout, pay transparency, return to the office, and so on. But what are some trends that you think that communicators should keep the pulse on and you kind of maybe for next year see, you know, on the horizon as being really, really critical for folks to pay attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the ones that you mentioned, AI, burnout, pay transparency, as we've talked about extensively, they're certainly still extremely relevant and topical and are going to continue to be so. And they are also, you know, of a great interest to me personally as well. I think that we need to still tell many more stories about structural inequities because there are still people who are blind to these and still people in positions of leadership and in positions of power who do not understand the extent and the role that they play in enabling these inequalities to exist. And just coming back to your question from earlier around what surprised me most when I was writing about the book, this kind of relates to that because I think one of the most remarkable things that happened when I was doing initial reporting for the book was that I discovered that a lot of business leaders believed, or at least they claimed to believe, that much of the gender pay gap, for example, was actually attributable to women choosing to not be as ambitious in the labor market as their male counterparts. And so I think that that is exemplary. It just exemplifies that the information out there is still not adequate. People in leadership, in positions of power, still don't truly understand why inequality is bad, that inequality exists, and that they have a responsibility to do something about it.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that narrative before where it's sort of this, well, there's a lack of ambition for advancement, and that's what's, you know, which is clearly not the case. But, you know, that seems to be something that comes up now and again.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, just placing this onus on women. And obviously, the narrative around women leaning in that was popularized by Sheryl Sandberg has value, right? I think that was an important piece of writing from her, and it was an important contribution to the conversation. But I think it's dangerous in the sense that it places the onus on the marginalized to fix something that is not their fault, right? And that can't be fixed by a single portion of a demographic group. It has to be fixed by everyone.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, I really appreciate your time, and your book sounds fascinating. We always ask one question to our guests, which is what gets up in the morning. I'm assuming it's probably your children if you're doing drop off this morning. So, but also, you know, the question is, you know, what motivates you? What drives you through your day?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, as cliched as it sounds, and I'm sure this is an answer you've heard before, I love doing my job and I consider it to be nothing short of remarkable that I actually get to do it every day. I get paid for it, sometimes not quite as much as I want, but, you know, and, you know, I also consider it to be a responsibility. So that sense of responsibility drives me on. I found myself in a very fortunate position, of course, through hard work and through ambition, but also just through privilege, let's be honest, that I'm able to report and write articles for a living and write a book and take that time to do that. And I fully appreciate that I belong to a tiny minority that is able to pursue a profession that they want, that they're passionate about. And so, you know, I don't want to take that for granted. I don't want to waste that opportunity. And I'll do that by, you know, ensuring that my work can have a really positive impact on not just myself and my own career, but something hopefully far greater and more enduring, I suppose, than myself and my career.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Josie. And you know, I really appreciate your time. And I think the listeners will really enjoy this. And thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Spend- Special thanks again to Josie for joining us on this episode of Pod Catalyst and sharing more about some of the fascinating work she's been doing. If you want to learn more about her or her upcoming book, check the show notes for links. And thanks as always to you, our listeners, for tuning into us. We'll see you next time.